Welcome to the Planet Trillion Trees podcast. I'm Eva Monheim.
And I'm Hal Rosner. We are both certified arborists through the International Society of Arboriculture. The purpose of our podcast is to encourage tree planting and proper tree care for our urban forests, which include neighborhoods, parks, and other open spaces.
We will also cover a myriad of tree topics, including the important role trees play in relationship to the climate crisis. Thank you for joining us.
Verdant Earth Educators provides dynamic in-person training and online learning opportunities for environmental and horticultural businesses. Owned by ISA-certified arborists and former university faculty, the Verdant Earth Educator team provides consultations on tree care and recommends climate-resilient opportunities for your valued green spaces. Verdant Earth Educators is all about seeding knowledge for success. Find Verdant Earth Educators at verdanteartheducators.com.
We'd like to thank our sponsor, Monheim Microphones. Monheim Microphones designs and handcrafts top-tier studio microphones and preamps right here in the United States in Hollywood, California. Their incredible line of innovative microphones and designs are used around the world by everyone from podcasters to top-charting record producers and singers. They recently released their new royalty microphone, Monheim Microphones Unparalleled Excellence, monheimmicrophones.com.
Hear from the most influential and innovative voices in today's global garden community at the annual Andalusia Garden Symposium. Famed plantsman and garden writer Dan Hinckley, Sissinghurst's head gardener Troy Scott Smith, Welsh seasonal floral designer and author Lucy Hunter, and edible landscape architect and author Stephanie Bittner. Held on Friday, May 3rd at Andalusia Historic House, Gardens, and Arboretum in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, just outside Philadelphia. Tickets are on sale now at andalusiapa.org.
This podcast is being recorded on March 8th, 2024. Dan Hinckley is a plantsman, author, lecturer, nurseryman, and a horticultural consultant. He earned his Bachelor of Science in Horticulture and a Horticultural Education from Michigan State University, and he has a Master of Science in Urban Horticulture from the University of Washington. His first garden, Heronswood, near Kingston, Washington, is now owned and operated by the Port Gamble Sklallam Tribe and is open to the public throughout the year. His current garden, Windcleft, is just a few miles from Heronswood. It sits on a high bluff overlooking the Salish Sea. For 40 years, Hinckley has traveled the globe to similar climates to observe and preserve plants that deserve recognition as possible new additions to landscapes worldwide. He has written 4 books and has been recognized by his peers in receiving numerous awards for his work, including the Liberty Hyde Bailey Award from the American Horticultural Society, the Scott Gold Medal Award from the Scott Arboretum, and the Vetch Memorial Medal from the Royal Horticultural Society. Welcome to the Planet Trillion Trees podcast, Dan. We're delighted that you could be with us today.
Thank you so much.
Well, it's a pleasure to meet an icon like yourself because you have an incredible background. And we want to hear a little bit about how you got started in horticulture and how you became a plant hunter.
Okay, well, let's go back 4.5 million years when I was a child. I grew up in northern Michigan. It was a small town. My parents were busy, as all parents are, but we did have the opportunity to be exposed to the outside world more than what I think a lot of kids are today. And it was through those interfaces with the natural world, mushroom hunting, walking around woods, the woodlots adjacent to my home, that I became intrigued by plants. And as a very young kid, planting seeds with my dad, morning glories and squash, and that thrill of watching them germinate, push their cotyledons up through the soil, was just something that I was completely entranced by, and I feel fortunate to have discovered that at such an early age, because it led me to places unimaginable. I continued onward with my interest in plants throughout high school, and then got my undergraduate degree in horticulture from Michigan State University.
You were really influenced by watching nature, but also activities within your own home that really got you hooked onto horticulture. Is that correct?
Yeah, I feel really fortunate that my parents made sure that we were outside and our family activities were surrounding the outdoors. My mom was the first leader of the Junior Audubon Society in Northern Michigan. So
wow.
We got more birds, and my dad knew his trees. He grew up in the region. So I just developed a really strong interest in those plants as a really young kid.
So now, what took you out to the West Coast? Was it your work experience in horticulture that took you out to the West Coast?
Well, I refer to it as the Great Lutheran Migration Westward. My siblings moved out one by one, and then I would come to visit them in Washington State during the summer. I was teaching horticulture in Michigan at that time, and each year it became harder and harder to go back. And so ultimately, I became the last of four siblings to move to Washington. Yeah, it would be hard to go back to Zone 4 after governing Zone 8 for all these years.
I can certainly relate to that. I totally hear what you're saying. You know, you always wonder what takes people from one location to another. But when your plant palette opens up like that to a different zone, it's just remarkable. Yeah. It changes your life. And obviously, it did for you.
Yeah, it has been remarkable. As a kid, you know, I had a Scheffler as a houseplant, and now here I'm growing 10 different species of Scheffler out in my garden in northern temperate area there where I garden. So it's pretty amazing that I'm here.
Yeah, tell me, looking out your windows or being out on your back patio, I'm sure you have a back patio. Tell me what you see as far as your tree canopy. What kind of trees do you have in your landscape that would interest our listeners?
Well, from where I'm sitting right now, I see one of our most iconic trees in the Northwest, the Pacific Madrone, which is essentially a tree rhododendron, if you want to look at it that way, in the same family as rhododendrons. It's one of the few broadleafed evergreens that we have in the Pacific Northwest as a native. And the bark is somewhere between cinnamon and with streaks of green and ebony, flaky bark, glossy leaves. In the wintertime and the summer, like when the sun hits it on the side, if it's wet from rain, as it often is, about 355 days a year, and or if it's just at that right time of the night or morning when the bark illuminates, is just absolutely sublime. That rests right on our bluff overlooking the Puget Sound. We also have an enormous Eby's grandis, the grand fir, that sits right on the bluff edge. It's sometimes hard to imagine that it is able to hold on in these really tremendous windstorms that we have, but it's not yet given up. And we're hoping it doesn't. Well, we're in the kitchen because it will definitely come right through where I'm sitting right now. But those are two of the main trees that I'm looking at. Our bluff side, the south side of the house, is primarily garden space and not covered with an overstory of native trees. We didn't clear it. It was that way when we moved in. With that said, we are allowing madronas to come up and sow themselves about in the garden, even though that they will take our view away for a few years. I'm gardening for the future here, I think, and believing that in 50 years, people will be appreciative of the fact that I let these madronas come up and stabilize the soil and provide a little shade during our increasingly warmer summers here in the Northwest.
So now your garden that you're sitting in or your home is in is about 6.5 acres and it's called Wincliff. Is
yeah,
that correct?
That's right. Yeah. Wincliff is the name that it was given by the previous owners. We didn't give it that, but it's an appropriate name. We get blasted by the southern winds when they come in across the Puget Sound. We're 200 feet above the water. And so with an expansive view of water and sky and Mount Rainier in the distance in downtown Seattle.
Wow, it sounds absolutely beautiful. Now, of course, you are responsible for starting Heronswood Nursery earlier in your career. And if you could tell us a little bit about that, because that's when I heard about you from Heronswood. You know, everybody was talking about Heronswood.
And right.
It's a very special place. Can you tell us about Heronswood and why it's such a special place?
Yes. And I still find it to be a very special spot. And I would say it was a place that wanted a garden. You know, the plants grow well there. They always have. And it was almost as if it was waiting for a gardener to come along and start planting. The soil type, there's a fairly high water table, but it's not a damp soil. And it just grows really, really good plants. And they continue to grow. When I go back to visit on a weekly basis, as I do, I'm just astounded how large things have become and how healthy things still continue to appear.
That was a nursery, or it still is a nursery, is that correct?
No, it was a nursery and a garden. The garden and the nursery were born together and fed each other. Then we sold the nursery and garden to W. Attlee Burpee in 2000. They shuttered it in 2006 and then began the process of trying to find another buyer, which was, you know, somewhat heartbreaking for us. But in 2012, the Port Gamble Sklallam tribe, one of three tribes on our peninsula, they successfully bid for it at auction. And now they are one of the very few native tribes in North America to own a botanic garden, which has been a really incredibly exciting prospect, bringing two very distinct communities, the native people and the non-native community, together in one place in a garden, which I think is an amazing thing that happened. In a garden is where we got to know our neighbors who we had never really become acquainted with before.
So it's very fitting that they would buy it and take it on and do something that maybe other native people have not done in the past, because I know land ownership it's communal rather than individual. And I think that's really wonderful that they have taken it on. I was reading up on your garden and I just thought that was an amazing opportunity for them to take it on. And are those plants that are on that property in that garden, are they part of your plant hunting collection? Is that how the garden got developed over time?
Yes, that's probably its inherent value to the botanical and horticultural community of North America, is that many of the plants there have known provenance, meaning I have records to show precisely where those plants were collected by seed. So going forward, that's very important for study purposes, for, you know, DNA analysis, even for conservation. We know through my records, through the work that I did during those years, precisely where those plants arose.
Will those plants also be considered for plant breeders as well, to think about how they can be utilized in the larger sense or larger global sense?
Oh, I think that the plants at Heronswood have already been used to a considerable degree in plant breeding. People need the raw data. Plant breeders need that raw data from the wild in order to build upon their creations. And so to have new species brought into cultivation that have not been there before aids them, and of course, ultimately benefits the horticultural community with better looking, stronger, healthier.
Yeah, I saw that you had hydrangea spara there, and you know, that one there, I mean, years ago, people really never even heard of it. I mean, it was found in a collection, or, you know, like yourself, if you collected it, it came into visual context for some people, but it wasn't very popular. And I saw that and I go, I know that's being used in breeding right now for hydrangeas. And I just think that you're responsible for so many new plants here in North America. That has gone a long way, especially Agapanthus, I think, that you were responsible for. You've done a lot of plant traveling through Asia, through Korea. Can you tell us a little bit about those places that you were doing hunting?
You know, my draw was, has been, and continues to be Asia, but that hasn't limited me by any stretch of the imagination to just that part of the world. I've looked at plants in South Africa, hence the Agapanthus, South America, New Zealand, Australia, and then throughout really a lot of Eastern Europe as well, China, Myanmar, Bhutan, Taiwan, Japan, Korea, and most importantly, Vietnam, where I've been 20 times over the course of the last 30 years. So all of those trips, I like to describe as bringing back another piece of the jigsaw puzzle at the end of each trip, and then piecing them together to give me a better idea of what the flora of the entire Earth looks like and feels like. And it's really quite remarkable, you know, that there's a continuum of plants from north to south and east to west, continuum of species. You don't step across an artificial line of demarcation from one country to another, from one state to another, and all of a sudden have a completely new palette of plants. It's just a variation on a theme. And so getting out to look at plants in the wild gives you a much better idea of that continuum, of that interconnectedness of the life systems on Earth, and that you can virtually go anywhere and see relatives of plants that you have in your own backyard.
So are you trying to recreate Pangaea?
Oh, no. I don't have it in my budget to recreate Pangaea.
I always think, you know, when I'm talking to my students about woody plants, I'll say to them, you know, pretty much all the white pines, five-needle pines, are related. They're found pretty much in the same latitude around the Earth. And when you look at them, you can see the similarities and, of course, the differences. And, you know, what makes a plant look different in a different place? What forces a needle to be longer versus shorter? You know, I think about all those things when I'm teaching and when I'm looking at plants. And I would imagine that when you're looking at plants from different parts of the world and they're in the same genus or species, probably just genus, that you'll see those similarities, that you'll see things that look very similar besides the flower parts, because that puts them in the same family. But I'm talking about the plant itself, the little bit of differences and the similarities.
Your eye becomes trained without you trying to train it. You know, I think a similar profoundness exists in people that sex chickens. It sounds weird.
Yes, I understand what you're saying. Yes.
You can't train your eye to do it. It's just repetitive. And after a while, your eye starts to see things without you really realizing how you got there. So over time, I've been able to pick out maples, for instance, just by an element of light or structure in amongst dense vegetation, a maple becomes very apparent to me. And I can't tell you exactly how or why, but that's just one example. And it's repeated over and over again, whether it be a stachyrus or a rhododendron, Schefflera, it goes on and on. Your eyes become adept at picking out textures and structures that you wouldn't normally believe possible.
Do you think that your familiarity with plants as a young child and through your collections that actually helps you when you're going out in the wild to hunt?
Oh, absolutely it does. I learned leaf arrangement as a kid, you know, the opposite leaved plants versus alternate leaved. And then I go through all of those lists in my mind still when I'm out in the field looking at something that I'm not quite certain what it is. I go through those lists in my mind of, you know, is it a compound leaf? Is it a simple leaf, pinnately compound or palmately compound? Are the leaves opposite or alternate? Are they whorled? And all of those things are what I learned plants from as a kid, and I'm still employing them to this day.
I think that when we start, when we're very young with something, it seems to be like the trigger that helps us later on in life. You know, you may not do it your whole life, but when you come to it as a profession, all of a sudden it clicks and everything just kind of falls into place. And that it sounds like that's what kind of guided you through your education and through your master's program and out to Washington, looking at those plants that had probably become more familiar to you as you went to visit your family too. So you became more keen on those plants versus your native habitat in Michigan, for example. Do you think that that all plays into it?
Yeah, I think so. If I understand the question, the overt of writing theme is just the love of the process, the love of the individual plants as nouns, not as verbs. It's humbling to know what is out there, the variation, the intricacies of pollination and seed dispersal, all of those things that I think a lot of us walk by and don't recognize. You take the time to surround yourself with it enough to where you do notice it and you think, gosh, what an amazing system that is in order to replicate that life form. And I feel blessed to have been exposed to it at such a young age. But at the same time, I am a person that knows a tiny, tiny little bit about a lot of plants rather than a tremendous amount about just a few plants. And I respect those people that devote their lives to studying just one genus or one species or one variety of a species, but I'm not one of those people. So I feel oftentimes that my reputation, having deep knowledge of plants, is not fully justified at all. I'm just smart enough to remember plant names and apply them to the right plant.
And would you say that you're a generalist then, rather than a specialist?
I'm a generalist, absolutely, I am. And I guess, attention deficit disorder is probably key to my success in having a nursery, a couple nurseries, is that I don't get caught up into the minutia of a single plant, but have exposed myself to a huge number of plants over my career.
I'm going to go back to Heron's Wood again, and I want to ask you, when a person comes to visit there and steps into it, what kind of feeling do they get? What kind of awe do they feel?
I think that there was a richness at Heron's Wood to the forest floor, the carpet of species that we laid down in a rather naturalistic style that speaks to a lot of people when they visit. The secondary layer of the smaller trees and shrubs that you're walking through, planted for seasonality to span the year of interest, winter blossom and bark and berries, and of course the summer flowers as well. And then the large overstory trees. In the case of Heron's Wood, it's primarily Western Red Cedar and Douglas Fir. And now, going on 45 years, since we purchased that property, those have become quite large. When you're tending a garden under a forest, it's important to note that it's not just your garden that grows, but it's the trees that are over your garden that are going to grow as well. A very important lesson for people starting a garden in a woodland. Well, I'm told that people feel as if they're walking into a cathedral when they walk into our woodland garden. The power of the height of the trees and the girth of the trees, but still at the same time, a lot of really interesting plants at your feet.
So you're telling the listeners that you have a very tall ceiling, probably Gothic in style or something like that, and that the entire cathedral is filled with all kinds of artwork and beautiful furnishings from top to bottom. That's what I'm kind of visualizing here as we're talking. Something that people need to realize that woodlands should be, when I say furnished, I'm talking about having living beings from the floor all the way up to the tippy top of the soaring canopy. And yet our forests have been neglected in that way because we've had so many iterations of movement through our forests. And that's what I'm thinking of when I'm thinking of your forest, as you described it, the floor.
Every tree, essentially every tree has a vine growing on it as well. And that verticality is so important to take control of the upper atmosphere of the garden. It's yours. You have control over it. So use it. Climbing hydrangeas, an assortment of self-adhering vines to the trunks is what we use. It increases wildlife habitat and interest throughout the year. So, and makes the overhead as interesting as the carpet at your feet.
You've answered some of this already. How has your work actually helped people to appreciate plants from around the world, especially in light of the climate crisis with the disappearance of species? You know, why do you think that is important? And why do you think it's important to bring things that are new and different to have people see in a garden? And why is a botanic garden important?
Well, I think a lot of people that visit botanic gardens, just as a lot of people that visit the grocery store, don't understand the origins of the plants, or in the case of grocery stores, the product. And understanding that origin would help in creating, I think, a bit more respect for the need for conservation and care for the planet in other countries, not just in our own. So I think that's inherently the importance of a botanic garden. They teach people not only the breadth of interest and intricacies in the natural world in terms of plants, but also the importance of walking a little bit more gently wherever we might be, and understanding that there really is no turning back. Once a species is gone from its natural habitat and we've lost it before we've had a chance to study it, I mean, that's it. And there's a finality to it that's a bit troubling.
I like the way you put that. And I really appreciate you explaining it that way. Not everybody can travel as much as you have and to see what you've seen and the environments that you've seen. But having them see these plants in a botanic garden might give them a better appreciation, I think, is what you're saying, of a habitat that they may not have seen, but at least they're appreciating that particular plant from that habitat. I really think that that's so important. We know that you're going to be speaking at the Garden Symposium at Andalusia, which is coming up on May 3rd. This is the second year for it. If those listeners don't know, Andalusia is a garden that sits north of Philadelphia in Bucks County. And it's a beautiful preserved property. It's over 70 some acres. And they are trying to raise money to have an intern there during the summertime. And so the symposium came about, and they're trying to get really top-notch speakers like yourself. So, you know, what are you going to be talking about? What do you hope to gain from presenting at this symposium?
Well, I'm going to talk about my current garden, Wincliffe, and its development and the reasons behind it, and the fact that it too will change over time as I mature as a gardener, just as this garden is much different than Heronswood. The garden that I'm currently in 10, 15 years is going to be much different than it is now, as my tastes refine and my approaches become different. But what do I hope to gain is what I always gain when I travel about to speak, is to meet other gardeners, to see that spark of interest in their eyes when it comes to plants. There's no faking that. You're either passionate about plants or you're not. And it's just rewarding for me to meet people that have those same feelings I do. And I always learn something, you know, going to a place like Andalusia, I'll come back with ideas for my own garden. And it's a very reciprocal ordeal wherever I go. And that I attempt to give something of myself and my background and the things I've learned as a gardener, but I return with great ideas and admiration for the places that I've visited and apply those things into my own style of gardening.
So I think it's a win-win for you, yeah, right?
Except for the air travel.
Well, yeah, I can understand that. Coming from the West Coast to the East Coast, yes. You know, you have been very prolific as an author, and I want to talk a little bit about that. You've written 4 books, is that correct?
Yes, I've written 4 books.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about your books and how you got started in writing and what possessed you to write your first book? I think people who are writers would really appreciate something like that.
I found a little bit of self-worth in writing as a kid. In high school, my teachers that I had to write something for gave me positive feedback about writing and about my ability to write. And that gave me the confidence to go forward with it a bit more. I wrote my first book on winter ornamentals, which is something I really believe in deeply, that you should plant a garden for all four seasons. And if you plant for winter, the rest of the seasons tend to take care of themselves. But the others then began to focus on my travels. And I keep a journal always when I'm traveling. And also, I had to write 20 volumes of the Heronswood catalog, always incredible practice on a yearly basis, trying to condense the description of a plant down to a reasonable amount of space. And I still do that as I have a nursery here at Wincliff still, and I write plant descriptions on labels. I only get so many characters to describe a plant and can't get too purple about it. Try to capture the essence of a plant and throw in a bit of humor at the same time. There's nothing wrong with laughing in horticulture and even laughing at yourself. There's nothing wrong with that either. I am finding it more and more difficult, to be honest, writing as I age. Maybe it's because I'm starting to feel like it's all been said before. And I guess I would rather spend my time doing than actually writing about it. In a world, I might add, where there's a lot of people that are writing about something they don't do. So I want to make sure that I'm not adding to that.
You want to be authentic.
I try to be, yeah.
That sounds like what you're trying to do. And not everybody is authentic, right? This has been really delightful to talk with you, Dan, and to hear about how you got started and what inspired you. I hope one day that I can get to see Heronswood. But I want to ask you the question that my colleague, who usually is with me, who's out under the weather today, we usually ask the question, what is your favorite tree? I know as a parent, it's kind of hard to say what's your favorite child, but you know, a group of trees or a tree, that would be fantastic.
Oh boy, okay. I mean, that's, you know, on what hour?
Right, exactly. It's actually 5:15 p.m. here in the East. So you can pick anyone.
You know, I have to say that as that generalist that I am, I have so many trees that I love. And it's just virtually impossible for me to say this. If I only had space for one tree, what would that be? Because it would end up being the one tree that I had to have that started with A, and then the other one B, and then the other C, and it goes on and on. You know, I could bore you to tears going through my favorite trees right that I'm looking out to right now in my current garden. But I will have to settle with M for maple or A for Acer as the group of plants that I have developed the greatest amount of affection for. And that goes back to my youth, because in Michigan, I grew up with the sugar maple and the red maple, Acer rubrum and Acer saccharum. And we had a box elder, Acer negundo, in our front yard. And we had a silver maple, Acer saccharinum. So I got to know all of those plants as a young kid. And then in my travels, I've added to that life list. And I still find them to be the most noble of all trees on Earth, at least in the temperate areas of Earth. So they win today.
That's an excellent answer, Dan. That's an excellent answer. And I kind of had a feeling you were going to say Acer. I don't know why, but I did. And rarely have we ever heard someone say Acer negundo on our podcast, which I think is a darn shame, because it's a fantastic tree.
It's certainly
tree.
The most un-maple-looking maple there is.
That's exactly right. You can certainly confuse a lot of people looking at that and say, hey, take a look at my maple on my front lawn.
Exactly. Well, as a kid, we had a leaning Acer box elder, Acer negundo. It had a considerable lean. And I might be amongst the few that had to call the fire department to have our dog rescued from a tree. Our deer dog, Mitzi, chased the squirrel up the tree and got into the branches and could not get down. So there you have it.
Oh my goodness. That's a really good story.
I think of, when I think of Ace Nagundo, oh my gosh, I was 4 years old when that happened. So it still feels like yesterday.
That's funny. Well, I'm looking forward to meeting you in May, on May 3rd.
Thanks. It's been delightful talking to you. I'm looking forward to meeting you as well and spending some time together and talking about trees.
And enjoy the garden.
Thank you so
much. Take care, Dan.
All right. Thanks again. See ya. Bye.
Take care. Trillion Trees podcast is edited by Andromeda Recordings in Hollywood, California. Thank you.